the people. So on Saturday morning, right at, I had to, that's why I had to move us, is because of this prayer call, which I, when I first agreed to it, I thought it was at 6:40 my time, because I got confused between Central and Eastern time. And as a result, you know, I got into this thing, which I start at 7:20 on Saturday morning, and usually it should be done by 8 o'clock, but in the last couple of weeks, that's not been the case. But probably because I talk too much. Anyway, as you probably well know. So welcome everyone to the House of the Risen Son with Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson. And we're going through the new book by Gary Renard. And I still have to get a, review of this. I promised Gary I'd do a review of it, which I haven't done yet, but that should be my thing to do today.
you can just look at the one I did on Amazon, put ditto.
Okay, how about I do that? That sounds good. Yeah.
I gave it glowing remarks, so.
Yay. Yeah. Excuse me. All right, so when we left off last week, actually I went ahead and read on after, because you had to leave
good,
a little early.
Good. Yes, I did.
So I read on to where it starts with Gary saying, all right, now we're getting somewhere. I want details. And so Artin and Persa are talking about Saka and Hiroji, who were interested in the same woman, and her name was Megumi. So Meg and there was a little triangle going on there between Jesus and Buddha and this girl Meg. So,
Meg, for sure, huh? So what page are you on?
Let's see, that would be, is it page 21?
I had my bookmark on 21 also, so.
Okay.
So
Gary's saying he wants details, if you can find where he says that. Persa says, the first thing you need to understand is that whether it shows or not, people feel on a very deep level.
Okay.
Oh, see, I got you confused.
I like to say, you must have read several pages further, you think?
Maybe a page or two further, I think.
Okay. And it was Persa's.
Let's just go back to where you had us. It doesn't matter. Cause
oh, okay. All right. Well,
this is not like a cliffhanger from last week. What is he going to say? But let's just start where we left off.
Okay. Probably the easiest place to find is would be at the bottom of page 20 in the hard copy that I've got. You want me to start there?
Sure.
Okay. And that's...
copy here. I should be looking at it. Then I'd know what page you're on.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Anyway, go ahead.
Okay, sure. Let's see. Okay. Yeah, Artin says, in a while we'll talk about a couple of the early peak experiences Jay and Buddha had at the time of Lao Tzu. But one important distinction to make before that is that unlike the ideas of Shintoism, with Taoism, the Tao is formless. So when the Taoist Saka and Hiroji, whose names we'll give you later, excuse me, had mystical experiences, they thought of the dream that they returned to differently than they did when they were Shintos. It's a different level of awareness. By the way, when it comes to awareness, there's something you should remember about all people, whether you are fond of them or not. Everyone is doing the best they can with the level of awareness that they have. Boy, that's a really great reminder, isn't it? It takes the condemnation, judgment, and misinterpretations that our egos love to foster out of it. You know, knocks the wind out of all of that, doesn't it?
Well, it does, and you know, that is kind of reminiscent, or it goes along with the thoughts of Carl Rogers, where we deal with people with unconditional positive regard. Mm-hmm. Also, mm-hmm. Concept of the I forget what it's called. Anyway, it's just assumption of positive. That's what it is. Assumption of positive intent.
Uh-huh.
Which is a something that has been really going around lately in the mindfulness circles, is that we assume that everyone has a positive intent. If you assume that everyone has a positive intent, then guess what? You can stop blaming them for the mistakes they make and just recognize they're trying to do the best they can. And it's interesting because I just got off this prayer call and we were talking about today's workbook lesson, God Goes With Me Wherever I Go. And, you know, that's really what it is. It's assumption of positive intent. It's assumption that no matter what is happening, in fact, Jesus says to us, deep within you is everything that is perfect, ready to radiate through you and out into the world. It will cure all sorrow and pain and fear and loss because it will heal the mind that thought these things were real and suffered out of its allegiance to them. So, you can never be deprived of your perfect holiness because its source goes with you wherever you go. You can never suffer because the source of all joy goes with you wherever you go. You can never be alone because the source of all life goes with you wherever you go. Nothing can destroy your peace of mind because God goes with you wherever you go. And we were talking about this concept in the group, and you know, someone said, well, that means that God goes with my brother-in-law, who's a jerk, wherever he goes. They didn't say this in particular. God goes with President Trump wherever he goes. God goes with whomever, wherever they go. Bruce, Lynn, you fill in the blank. God is with them. So this assumption of positive intent, this idea that people are trying to do the best they can under whatever circumstances they're in, is essential. It's important and necessary in order for us to truly forgive. That means letting go of all the thoughts that we have about the intention and the fault and the guilt and whatever of everything around us, and just recognizing that God is in it. And God is in me. God is the mind with which I think. You know, God is in everything. So quit your bitching. You know? They're all doing what they're supposed to be doing.
Yeah, I think, you know, as Ken Wapnick says, you can never really get too far from the metaphysics of the Course, and if you want to stay out of trouble. And again, you know, the reality of what we really are is beyond space, beyond time, beyond bodies and personas and individuality. And so, you know, the idea of God going with us wherever we are is really basically yet another example of a workbook lesson that meets us at the level where we think we're at, to give us, you know, a sense of comfort and assurance and encouragement and certainty that we can afford to truly connect with and rely on, until we let go of the idea that you know, that there is materiality, because that's just a misperception that we've made in order to you know, I was thinking about right after I said that, the fill in the blank phrase is, that's really what we're doing here in this world. We're telling ourselves that this world, which it really is a hologram of nothingness that we've made a big deal out of, and we've filled it in. We filled in this blank thought with an entire cosmology of space and time and people and stuff. And, you know, it seems like a big, you know, super deal. But in truth, it's just a classroom for us to look at our minds, you know, seen rightly anyway. It's an opportunity for us to see where we believed that we blew up, destroyed, killed perfect oneness, and in its place made a substitute that has had these horrific ramifications and has given cause in our minds only to reason to feel grievances and victimhood and all this, the whole realm of stuff. But it's just silly. It's just so in a sense, you know, to get back to that quote, you know, everyone is doing the best they can with the level of awareness they have, because we think we're here. You know, we're trying to cope with an absurd notion that we made up and took so seriously that we, you know, brought in reinforcements from every conceivable part of perfect oneness that we thought we shattered, to try to convince us that this world is the real deal and that we have to deal with a world where, in fact, the only thing we really need to deal with in truth is the mind. Now, on the level of form, we obviously need to, you know, deal with the world as it, you know, appears to us, and of course wouldn't suggest that we do otherwise. But really, the multitasking assignment that's really, in truth, simpler than chewing gum and walking is to be mindful of our choice for which teacher while we're in the world and doing the things that we normally do, right?
So. That's it. And that's the only thing really that we can do. You know, that's what you have to be aware of.
Exactly.
All of this positive thinking, all of this willful, you know, I will for everything to be a certain way or whatever, all of that is really kind of useless because things are as they are. But what is not useless is connecting with our source and asking of all things, what is it for? Because then we really can see a truth, and we're not locked up in our own imagination of the purpose of what seems to be happening. And, you know, asking the Holy Spirit to give us that understanding is really the only, the key to our freedom.
Yep, it totally is. Yep.
Exactly. So let's see. So where are we at?
Sure. Gary then continues. Quick question before we continue. You never seem to mention Muhammad, and I think you've mentioned Zoroaster only once, back toward the beginning of the visits. Did Jay and Buddha ever come in contact with them? Martin, no. There's a good reason they didn't come in contact with Muhammad. He was 600 years after their final lifetime. Of course, that puts him 600 years after Thomas and Thaddeus, too. It's not that we have anything against Muhammad. It's just that they weren't personally connected on a level of form. Although, as we said, ultimately all of us are connected. As for Zoroaster, he was 1,000 years before the Japan time period we're talking about. And Jay and Buddha didn't know each other then. By the way, we did say you were once a Sufi Muslim, Gary. Yeah, but that was after Muhammad. As for Zoroaster, wasn't he in Iran? Artin, yes, but it wasn't called Iran at the time. It used to be called Persia. Persa. Getting back to the subject at hand, it turns out that Sokka and Hiroji were both interested in the same woman. Her name was Megumi. Gary, all right, now we're getting somewhere. I want details. Okay, so that I think that's that may have been where you left off or wanted to go back to, right? So do you want to pick up from there?
Sure.
Okay.
So now we're talking about Meg then. All right. okay. So now Gary says, all right, now we're getting somewhere. I want details. You know Gary, he's got to have the details. Although, you know, I think that's part of his persona. It's just the silliness on his part.
Yep.
Okay, so Persa, the first thing you need to understand is that whether it shows or not, people feel on a very deep level. Even if they look calm, there are usually some pretty deep feelings going on. Unless, of course, the feelings have been denied so completely that they're totally unconscious and the individual doesn't feel anything. But that's rare, and it's not the way it is for most people, even the quiet ones. And so this I think is something that is pretty well seen after you've been doing this mind training, is how deep these feelings are and how, I know so many people that say, I don't know what you're talking about, guilt. I don't feel guilt. I don't know. I don't feel guilty for the world. I don't feel guilty for anything that goes on. I don't feel guilty because, you know, and they have all these ideas, but then when you start pressing into their thinking and asking them questions like, you know, why do you march for women's rights? Why are you giving to save the children? Why do you get involved in, you know, politics or discussions about what is happening in the world? You know, why do you do these things? And when we start looking at the reasons that we do so many things that we do in the world, for me anyway, it came right down to guilt. You know, I felt guilty. I couldn't help everyone. I couldn't save everyone. If I sent them, you know, $5 a month, it would feed two children. You know, that didn't help my guilt because there's still millions of children starving. If I go out and march for women's rights, you know, that makes me feel a little bit better, but it doesn't change anything, you know, immediately in the world, and women are still suffering from lack of rights. You know, I'm perceiving a lot of suffering. My children, I look at my children and think, oh, I wish I could have done a better job with them. Why didn't I get a better job so that they could have, you know, had a better life? Why did I let this happen? You know, when we start looking at our lives and our past and our thinking, it comes out pretty evident that many, in fact, most of the things that we do in this world are based on a feeling of guilt, a feeling of fear, a feeling of, if I don't do it, no one else will. I'm responsible for all the suffering I see. And when we don't recognize that, then we just go around suffering. And we're sad, and we don't have that sense of joy. And, you know, that's the lesson today, too. You know, that's basically what it's talking about, is, you know, when you know that God goes with you wherever you go, he says the separated ones have invented many cures for what they believe to be the ills of the world. But the one thing they do not question is the reality of the problem. Mm-hmm. Yet its effects cannot be cured because the problem is not real. The idea for today has the power to end all this foolishness forever. And foolishness it is, despite the serious and tragic forms it may take. God goes with me wherever I go. And that's what Persa is saying. Whether you understand it or not, you feel this tragedy. And if you don't feel this tragedy, then you're not looking. So Gary then says, still waters run deep. And Persa said, yes. And in order to get what our two friends were like at that time, you need to know the kinds of things they paid attention to. You've heard many times in the various teachings that you should monitor your thoughts. You should watch your thoughts closely for conflict, negativity, judgment, and condemnation. That's true. But what most teachers don't realize is that it's just as important to monitor your feelings. Why? The truth is you're more likely to act out of your feelings than anything. Of course, most people don't realize that those feelings came about as a result of thoughts, often repetitious, that they've been having over a long period of time. The thoughts come first, and then they make the feelings. Sokka and Hiroji, being who they were, realized this. Also, being friends, they had long discussions and realizations about many things. All right, you want to continue?
Sure. Before we do, I was just reminded of another favorite quote from the Course that I find helpful once in a while when I remember it. And I'm going to paraphrase it as, you know, the of all the many causes of your suffering, your guilt was not among them, kind of thing. And something to that effect. And I think that's really helpful because that's usually the last place we look is to, you know, the deep attic, basement, you know, wherever. The places that we don't usually frequent in our mind that represent whether it's a conscious, active repression or an unconscious denial and avoidance, it doesn't really matter. It's basically we don't get to see it unless we have access to it. And the way we have access to it is beautifully ironic from the ego standpoint. Is, you know, the ego made the world to keep our thoughts from our awareness and to keep us mindless. But the irony is that Holy Spirit, in the best possible irony, turns it around and uses everything in our world as a mechanism to get back to the unconscious mind, and specifically to the unconscious guilt, which really is unfounded, but we don't know that until we look at it with the Holy Spirit. And we can't just look at it with our own thinking, because that's really, you know, the ego examining itself and studying itself, as the Course says it loves to do. but if we look at the unconscious guilt with Holy Spirit, which is to say looking at everything that bothers us or that we're upset about or that we feel like we're never doing enough, whether it's a charitable effort or trying to you know, make the world a better place in whatever way, or even when we, you know, get frustrated and lash out and do things that aren't obviously trying to make the world a better place, you know, whether it's abuse of others or abuse of ourselves, you know, ultimately, all those things can stem back to an idea that we somehow separated from perfect oneness. And it never happened, but we don't know that until we look at the contents of our unconscious mind. Huh?
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay. So, let's see. Okay. Here we go. Their powers of observation were excellent, which is also true of many people who are firmly on a spiritual path. They're more likely to notice things that most people don't pay attention to. They're more likely to question things. They're more likely to ask, what kind of a God could have made this kind of a world? And that was one of the questions I remember asking myself when I was just thinking about this the other day when I was a teenager and my mom was having a, you know, a sort of her own little metaphysical midlife crisis, and was not upset, was not happy with the church we'd been going to, you know, Presbyterian Church in Livermore, California, and when I was growing up, that, you know, it's nothing personal about them. It's just it wasn't doing it for her, you know, and so she was trying to find something that would work, and so she, you know, for number of months was dragging the family around all these different churches in the valley we lived in, and after, you know, exhausting those, I remember tagging along one of those outings, Sunday outings, and we sat in this some variation of Christian church, and the minister was going on about you know, God being angry with us, you know, and I thought, gosh, what, you know, it's something to that effect, you know, and it was like all this emotional stuff was welling up with me. I thought, well, gosh, why am I feeling this? And I finally just excused myself and went out and sat in the car until the sermon was over. And it's like, you know, I was just, even at that age, it was like wrestling. Well, why would there be this schizophrenic God? And why would I feel bad about, you know, what's being said? And so it was like, okay, an early wake up call that, you know, there's something going on here that you know, isn't being addressed by a formal religion for me, and evidently not for my mom either. And she kept searching until she found other metaphysical teachings that worked for her. But anyway, it was just kind of interesting to just, you know, flash back on that and how that was sort of an early precursor to being drawn to the Course and its pure non-dual metaphysical teachings that really do explain why, you know, we're never upset for the reason we think. We could see peace instead of this. You know, and it has nothing to do with anything that's going on outside of us. And yet, again, we can use everything that appears to be going on outside of us, seen properly as an effect of our mind, to get back to the cause and recognize that the ego's cause which is guilt, is totally unfounded. So, anyway. Should I read a little more?
Yes. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So Sakka and Hiroji picked up on many of the teachings of the time. For example, they realized the importance of breath. They learned to breathe deeply at all times until it was second nature. I could probably pay more attention to that, too. Gary, I noticed I always feel better when I breathe deeply. It took me quite a while to do that because back when I first wanted to, I played my guitar in nightclubs and dances and stuff, and they still allowed smoking in public buildings. All the smoke rose right up to where we were on the stage, and I didn't feel much like breathing deeply. But once I moved to Maine, I started to always do it, whether I was meditating or not, per se. Yes, and speaking of meditation, Sakka and Hiroji became very proficient at it. It was something that would help them in later lifetimes. Gary, so they got into a lot of things, even though, as you say, it was still dualistic. Arton, yes, the main difference with Sakka and Hiroji was that even when they were on a dualistic path, they were already questioning the validity of what people call life. They were already sensing it was all an illusion, although they wouldn't explore that more deeply until their next lifetime together. They'd notice other things too, for example, how to communicate with animals. Gary, they'd talk with animals? Arton, no. First, animals don't think in terms of words. Yes, they'll understand a few words that you repeat to them over and over, but that's not how they think. Animals think in terms of pictures. So if you want to communicate with an animal, then you have to practice sending pictures to the animal with your mind. If you do that and get good at it, you might be surprised. You know from the course that minds are joined. That's true with animals, and it's true with humans and animals, because there's only one mind. So you can send a message to the animal in their language, which is through pictures. You know how Luna always gets upset when Cindy leaves to do errands? Gary, yeah. It's okay if I leave, but when Cindy leaves, Luna has a conniption. I can relate to that with the two cats in our household. Persa, the next time Cindy leaves the two of you alone and Luna gets upset, send pictures to Luna with your mind. Send her a little movie showing Cindy coming home through the door, picking her up, hugging and kissing her. It will remind the cat that Cindy always comes home and loves her, and this time will be no different. Practice doing it. She'll get it. I've done that for years with our cats, too, so I mean, I understand that principle. Just, you know, the telepathic idea, so. Do you want to, and then note, I tried this technique next time Cindy left, and Luna started to whine. Luna calmed down immediately. Arden, and don't feel bad about Luna seeming to favor Cindy. Obviously, from the day you rescued her, to Luna, Cindy is mommy. And to a child, whether it's a baby human or a baby kitty, mommy is everything. Mommy is God. So to Luna, Cindy represents all the love in the world. Gary, and what am I, roadkill? Persa, not at all. Another thing that animals think is that they are part of a pack. That's true whether they're in the wild or domesticated like you. You're the male energy in the house, and Luna senses it. So she looks to you for protection. If something goes wrong, she comes to you. Gary, you know I've seen that. Like when we had that 5.6 earthquake. It was one of those rolling quakes, and the whole house started going up and down. It lasted only about 20 seconds, but it was pretty wild. As soon as it was over, Luna came running to me. Persa, there you go. You're not useless in her eyes after all. So now all you have to do is ask yourself, should you really be concerned about what a cat thinks? Gary, yeah, I'm making it real. Life's a bitch. But you're saying Sokka and Hiroji use this method to become excellent at communicating with animals? Persa, yes, and I don't recommend anybody try this, but it can also be done with wild animals. The person who does it, though, should be very accomplished in this area, and Sokka and Hiroji were. As for your time period, you'll be hearing more and more in the future about people communicating with animals, both at home and in the wild. The time will come when it's commonplace, but it will happen gradually. Can you give me an example of them communicating with the wild animals? Persa, sorry, but we can't. We don't want to encourage anyone to try what they did, and you know there would be someone who would try to do exactly what they did. The purpose of telling you about that time in Japan is to make you realize that all spiritual students go through the same steps at one time or another, and all these steps must be completed successfully. However, they will all lead to the biggest step, which everyone will get to when they're supposed to. As for our two friends, all of their efforts were about using their minds in more and more powerful ways. You have to master each step of the ladder, including the beginnings of spirituality that go along with dualism, and this is done one step at a time. A lot of people don't want to do the work that it takes to complete each step. They want to skip to the end. They think they can just say, quote, I'm enlightened, unquote, and it's done. It would be nice if it was that easy, but it's not. You've got to undo the ego.
Wow, and you know, I think we see that a lot. Or people will say, I'm awakened, or, you know, there's a lot of people who are claiming that state of being awake and being enlightened. And of course, when you look at it, and I use the standard that I use is A Course in Miracles and what Jesus tells us that we can do and will be able to do if we reach this state of enlightenment, which he says is just a change in a shift in perception. It's not like the world is different. It is different because I've shifted my perception, which also means that the only thing that's wrong here in this world is my perception. And so this whole idea of becoming enlightened is, you know, really shifting perception. And remember this, that Jesus says in the Course that he was a man just like everyone else, and he saw the Christ in everyone he saw, and so became aware. He became aware of the Christ in himself, and he remembered God. Mm-hmm. And when he remembered God, he was no longer associated with the body in the physical world. He was able to actually recognize that he was not the body and the physical world was not the real world. And then he was able to appear in form, just as Artin and Persa are appearing in form. And he says that there are many masters who do appear to us in form, if we can handle it, which apparently Gary could. But for the most part, they will whisper something in our ear, or they'll give us an idea, or a thought will come to us from them. But they can appear to us in form, and that's what Jesus did. He appeared in form. Apparently, maybe Buddha, he appeared in form. Artin and Persa, they appear in form. And the reason they do that is so that we, who can only interpret and understand form, can see them and know they're here. But I think that we're surrounded by them. I think we're surrounded by enlightened, awakened beings who are whispering things in our ears, who are giving us ideas and helping us to see the truth about things. So the idea of becoming enlightened, that's coming to the point where Jesus says to us, when you recognize there's no level of difficulty in miracles, that it's no different to raise the dead than it is to, make a peanut butter sandwich. Mm-hmm. It's the same, there's no difficulty in it. And, does that mean we're going to be raising up dead bodies? Or is that shift in perception a shift from seeing the body as what we are to seeing and knowing that that is not the truth at all? And when we have that shift of perception, that we know that the body and what we believe of the world is not true, and we see the truth, that's enlightenment. And I haven't seen anyone actually that claims to be enlightened who is able to walk through walls or turn water into wine or any of those things that Jesus purportedly did. So and I think he's saying we can do those things. Because we'll see the truth about the physical world, we'll see the truth about our physical body, we'll see the truth about the reality of these things, and instead of being the maybe the victim of the body, we become the master of the entire illusion. And that's what I think anyway, that's my thought. So, do you have any more comments on that? And that's why people, they want to skip to the end, Gary, Artin is saying, and, or Persa is saying, and that's it. People want to, what does Ken call it? Bliss ninny.
Well, that's certainly one manifestation of that, wanting to skip over steps, isn't it? Just assume that you're already there and, go straight to the above the line, using Ken's chart metaphor, truth, and not having to do the undoing portion of undoing of the ego, in your mind. But the thing of it is that, I think probably the most important factor of that is it would freak us out if a reality was revealed suddenly to us. And the Course mentions that in a number of places and suggests that, that would actually plunge us deeper into fear if the veils, were lifted, metaphorically. So we really, not that it's impossible or anything, but for most people, probably, suggesting that, those of us who have a lot more work to do, and I'm certainly including that. We get to look at all the grunge in our mind, the grievances, the victimhood, the guilt, the anger, the frustrations, all that stuff. Even just the most seemingly minor annoyances and irritations, all that stuff becomes our classroom to look at. How is Ken points out, if we're in any kind of feeling of victimhood or martyrdom or that, if we think that the world is doing something to us, we can pretty much figure we're at the bottom rung of the ladder and we've got a ways to go. we've landed back there with a thud if if we're in that state of mind. So I think it's helpful to recognize that first of all, kind of the cliche is, people who are enlightened don't claim to be enlightened, because what would be the motivation for doing that? Why would they care if anybody knew or not, right? And I was actually also kind of thinking about that sort of phrase that used to, I find, kind of discomforting, that, if you find Buddha on the path, kill him. I think a course's translation of that might be is, if you see something on the level of form that claims to be not on the level of form, you got to ask yourself, what? how could this be? Obviously, we can have expressions of right-mindedness here, and I think that's what a Course in Miracles not only says is possible, but suggests that we practice, is trying our best to, within the awareness that we have, as the first part that we read this morning suggests, we need to give ourselves slack and that we are doing the best we can, but within that, make every effort to be kind and to be helpful, but recognize that the real cause of that, that the true motivation for that, is releasing our attachment and identification with this insane egoic thought that suggests that separation was possible. And as we do that, we will actually be able to be more genuinely kind, because we won't be trying to get something from the world. We'll just reflect that shared interest as a natural expression of the state of the mind that engenders that, right? So.
Exactly. Absolutely. All right. So let's see where. Okay. I'm going to continue reading then.
Okay.
He says, I'm just going to say the last part of this. They think they can just say, I'm enlightened and it's done. It would be nice if it was that easy, but it's not. We've got to undo the ego. And that was Persa, I guess, talking. Artin, also a common mistake people make is that they think if they know something intellectually, then they know it. And we all know the difference between knowing and believing, but they don't. It's not enough to know something as a piece of information. You have to do it. And Gary says, that reminds me of something Jackie said. And no, Jackie is my sister-in-law, Cindy's sister. And I think you know Jackie pretty well, Bruce, because I know you talked to her.
A couple times a month I get on her show as a guest, and we have a really wonderful conversation about the course. And she's obviously, very tuned in, and we have a lot of fun sharing course stuff. And that's on her Blog Talk Radio program, which I can send you the link and you can post it.
A great idea. I'd love to do that.
Okay.
So she pointed out that a lot of course students will say, I had another forgiveness opportunity. And then she'll ask them, yes, but did you do it? Did you actually do it? And, that's a good question. It's like the lessons, we do the lessons. Do we do them? How is it that we're actually doing that? And that's when those opportunities come up, you better hang on and do what you're given guidance to do. Okay, Artin, exactly. It's not enough to know about forgiveness or even understand it. And that's rare enough. But once you do understand it, you have to get into the habit of doing it consistently. And that's true of all the steps on the ladder. As you learn them, you have to do them, or else you haven't really learned them. As you can, and isn't that how we learned all the crap we know already? We learned it, we practiced it. Say your ABCs, 1, 2, 3. What is that? A cow, a dog, a tree. We practice until we are so immersed in this illusion that it seems completely real to us. Even when we come from birth knowing nothing of it, we learn it and we practice it. And so Jesus Artin is saying, you got to practice this too, because you will not learn it unless you practice it, just like everything else in your life. So, as you can see from what we've said about our two friends, thank you for sending me that link.
Yep.
As you can see, as you learn them, you have to do them, or else you haven't really learned them. As you can see from what we said about our two friends, even with dualism, there are accomplishments that can be pretty advanced. Sakka and Hiroshi's Hiroji's spiritual progress was, flip the page, accelerating quickly, and by the end of this lifetime, they were ready for much more. And then, of course, Gary says, hey, what about the babe? Did you say her name was Megumi? And Persa says, yes, you know, Gary can't forget about the woman. Yes, she, Sokka, and Hiroji all grew up in the same area and were friends as children. As they became teenagers, though, both Sokka and Hiroji began to have feelings for Megumi. But because of their culture, they had a difficult time getting close to her. Gary, universal experiences. The same thing happened with me and the girl next door, Barbara. Unrequited love is a bitch. It's also a big forgiveness opportunity. Persa, yeah, but you did do it. Gary, sure, 30 years later. Persa, as for Sokka and Hiroji, they both had dreams of one day marrying Megumi. To their chagrin, however, there were numerous obstacles in the way of that ever happening. We said that in those days, the emperor owned everyone. Because of that, it wasn't uncommon for his family to arrange marriages. Some of them knew Megumi's family and arranged for her to marry a man that she had never met. Megumi loved Sokka, which he didn't know, but she had no choice but to go along with the will of the emperor's family. So the wedding took place, and the three friends could never see each other, leaving all of them deeply depressed. Gary, did they ever get over it? Well, apparently they must have. Persa, Megumi was never really happy, but she did her duty, lived out her life, had children, and was respectable in the eyes of her and her husband's families. That was a very big deal at the time, keeping your word and your honor. Another thing that was a big deal at the time and still is to a Shinto is that reincarnation is very real. That's because of the belief that the body is real. You know, as a student of the Course, that reincarnation is a dream. You're never really in a body. It's an optical illusion. But most Shintos didn't know that, and neither did Megumi. So she hoped for better karma. The belief in karma actually predated Taoism and Buddhism. It's an idea that's associated with Hinduism, which is much older. In any case, Sokka and Hiroji were very disappointed about the situation, and even though neither of them could be with Megumi, they developed a strange jealousy toward each other because they both had the same feelings for her. As you know, the ego can be very tricky. It almost ruined their friendship. In fact, they didn't see each other as much for a couple of years. Arten. Fortunately, they were both very intuitive and began to see the whole episode, as well as their lives in general, as a spiritual lesson. They sensed that they needed to forgive each other, even though they hadn't learned the art of doing that yet. So they did the best they could, and they did it pretty well. From then on, whether in that lifetime or others, they always forgave each other if they had to, and they did so quickly. Forgiving quickly is a sign of spiritual maturity. And even though they were still in a state of dualism, they realized forgiveness was an essential part of spiritual progress. They also began to question the whole system and logic of the cycle and birth and death, although they'd learn more about that later. So in that lifetime, and this is a long, long time ago, they learned about forgiveness. Of course, the forgiveness that they learned about was forgiveness of, you know, what they thought someone did wrong. Mm-hmm. And that is a big confusion. And a lot of people still who study A Course in Miracles make that confusion about forgiveness, that somehow forgiveness is about something that a person did and or something that, you know, some circumstance that caused some kind of discomfort or unhappiness. But obviously, forgiveness is not about any of those things. Forgiveness is, in reality, about recognizing that nothing ever happened. And so, you know, coming to the point where you're willing to forgive something you thought really happened is good, but coming to the point where you recognize that nothing ever happened, that's true forgiveness. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like I said, a lot of Course students confuse that as well. And still think it has to do with personalities.
Exactly. In fact, synchronistically, that's the name of Jackie Laura Jones's radio program is True Forgiveness Teachings. So I just posted another link in the chat window, which you might want to share. And she has some really good conversations and with other guests as well. And I'd encourage people if they're interested to check it out. So yeah, and as you say, it's all about. Ultimately recognizing that there's nothing outside of us to forgive. And that's really the only foundation where forgiveness is possible. Otherwise, it's what the Course calls forgiveness to destroy, which is basically saying, well, yeah, something really happened, which I think is what you were alluding to. You know, if we think that something really happened and then we have to forgive it, it's like, you know, building this obstacle to peace and then saying, okay, now I gotta, you know, dismantle this massive structure that I've erected. And why the essence of the profound teaching of true forgiveness is that if nothing really happened, the only thing we need to do is recognize that, and then the forgiveness has a genuine foundation, because if nothing happened, then there's nothing to forgive. And that's, you know, again, it's not an easy thing to do, because we've trained our minds so thoroughly to believe that the world is real, that we oftentimes just go there automatically, but we can train our mind to automatically go to the awareness that nothing happened over a period of time. And eventually, when that takes root, we just realize, why would I beat up on myself metaphorically by making a problem and then having to undo the problem I just made, instead of just saying, wait a minute, there really is no problem here. I just need to forgive myself for believing that the whole idea of problems, the whole thought system that is responsible for that misperception, is just bogus. It's just silly, as Ken Wapnick loves to say.
Absolutely. It is just silly. And so letting go of it should be so simple and so easy when we recognize how silly it is. But first you have to laugh.
Exactly. Yeah, and it really comes from, I think, a deep love, not just of, not of the little seemingly separate self, but a deep love of the real self that we all are and share, that our curriculum is, you know, helping us to remember and restore to our awareness, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Absolutely. And you know, we're getting there every day.
We are.
So, yeah. All right. You want to continue reading?
Sure. Let's see. Okay. I think we're on. We're the part about.
We're at
another thing that was a big deal at the time is about reincarnation. We'd read that one, right?
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, okay. It's. He ends with begin to question the whole system and logic of the cycle of birth and death, although they learn more about that later.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Right. So Persa continues, this and all of their experiences from their Shinto lifetime together were very useful to them in their next lifetime together, during which they came to know the master and partial author of the Tao Te Ching, Lao Tzu. The lifetime during which Jay and the future Buddha were students of Lao Tzu took place around 600 BC, which was 200 years before Buddha and about 50 years before Confucius. Once again, don't expect historians to agree on the times, but that's when it was. By the way, Confucius was a philosopher. He didn't have a set discipline or religion. Taoism, on the other hand, was a discipline. Gary, was Lao Tzu a believer in non-dualism? Arten, yes, absolutely. Boy, it's funny. My wife came across a quote from Lao Tzu years ago and put it in her email signature, and it really had an effect on me. And I, you know, reflecting on it, it's like, wow, that was, you know, very powerful non-dualism at the time that I, you know, before I got back into studying the Course and before I had read Gary's books. And anyway, so it was just kind of a momentary flash of, you know, a prior connection with a quote from Lao Tzu. Arten, yes, absolutely. He understood that everything that appears to have a form is an illusion, but the Tao is formless. This brings up a point we'll be making at times in these conversations. All of the teachers we're going to be talking about believed in non-dualism. They knew that the truth of oneness is true, and nothing else is true, period. Then what happens always is that some of their students take their teachings and devolve them into dualism. Then once the truth is changed, it gets passed on to the dream world as something that isn't the truth. That's been happening for thousands of years, just in this cycle of history, because the truth is too threatening to the survival of the ego. The ego's specialty is changing the truth, whether it's the Vedanta, Lao Tzu, Buddha, or A Course in Miracles. The only solution to that is what we've been saying to you since the 90s. You've got to undo the ego, or the ego will continue to undo the truth. It can't help it. That's what the ego does. It's like a survival machine. And, of course, the students and teachers don't know that they're changing the truth. It's like projection. They don't know they're doing that either. They just think they're right.
All right.
Do you want to go on?
Okay. And isn't that always the case? Is that first off, we do not even understand what non-dualism is. I don't know. Maybe I say we, and I'm probably being a little overbearing there, but I really haven't met a lot of people or heard a lot of people who seem to understand what non-dual really means, because they still will see one and the other, and they still will argue for another. They always argue, yeah, there is another, and it isn't just one. And so just the idea that there is no other is frightening. It's terrifying to people who don't really understand how that could be, or why that is, or why that is a good thing. You know, a lot of people just see it as being, you know, pretty damn scary. But in reality, it's a gift that there's no other. When you start realizing, oh, that just means that all of these things that seem outside of me, that seem to be so crazy, are really all in the heart of God. Everything that is happening is really happening in the heart of God. Nothing has ever left the heart of God. It's where we are is in, God is not in my heart. Although, you know, we say that God's in my heart, God's in my mind. Actually, I'm in the mind of God. I'm in the heart of God. And so, that's what non-duality means. And like I said, not many people get that part of it, because it seems so evident that that couldn't be possibly true, because look at my circumstance. But that's not the truth. So let's see. So did you read, was Lao Tzu a believer in non-dualism?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and you read the next paragraph also. Let me see where I'm.
So where I left off was Gary, and the cause is...
Okay.
Unconscious resistance to the truth.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I didn't flip the page. That's why. Okay.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So, and the cause is unconscious resistance to the truth, Gary asks. Arten, yes. Now, most people will take the word Tao to mean your path, but for Lao Tzu, the word has to be understood on two levels. Two levels. On the level of the world, yes, it would be your path, but on the macro level, it would be the truth, the oneness beyond the illusion. So the macro level is what can we call level one.
Mm-hmm.
And the other level would be level two, which is the things that happen on our path. But the truth is that, again, we are in the heart of God. And so the truth is there's nothing really happening. The truth is that none of these things that we perceive can be real. The truth that the course is just so eloquent about what we are and what's really happening here is true. The truth is true. There, nothing is really happening, but on the level of form, we see it. So, and the macro level, is the oneness beyond the illusion. And Gary said, would he call that God? Arden, no, the Chinese, as you know from your visits there, aren't too big on God. So to a Taoist, the truth is simply the formless truth. It wasn't until A Course in Miracles and pure non-dualism that you have the perfect oneness of God being acknowledged as the only reality, the ultimate truth. Of course, there was always a master here and there who knew the ultimate truth, but they weren't famous, nor did most of them care to be. And I think that's why if you see the Buddha on the road, kill him, because it really wouldn't be the Buddha. It would be, a form. And so Gary says, I always wondered about that. I mean, if you're really experiencing that the world is a dream and you're the dreamer, then why would it matter to you if anyone knew that you were enlightened? And, of course, it wouldn't, because there is no anyone to know I'm enlightened. There's no one else to know that.
that's a great metric for reminding ourselves, when we're invested in the world in some way or another. Do we care what the feedback is? Do we care what the outcome is? And I think Krishnamurti's, profound statement is that I found a quote on Facebook a year or two ago, and I shared it because I thought it was, this was great. And he says something to the effect of, what my secret is. My secret is I don't care what happens. Now, he obviously didn't mean that he was unfeeling or had no compassion, but in terms of what happens in the dream, if we can bring our mind back to the level of cause, then we realize that's the only place, the only true freedom, as the Course says, is we have our choice of choice of teachers, and that's the decision making fulcrum or the blue dot in Ken's chart, the place in our mind that says, oh, I can either believe in the idea of separation, or I can choose to not believe it, and that's what makes all the difference, and that's really what brings us out of the dream, ultimately, and returns sanity to our mind, huh?
Yeah, absolutely, and we're all heading there.
yeah, it's inevitable. That's something that's truly comforting, and that feeling of inevitability of having never left in truth, even though it sounds like a nice intellectual concept to us most of the time, if we really allow that to sink in, what cause would we have for any anxiety or worry over things in the world? I'm saying that to myself because I catch myself having those kind of thoughts, not infrequently. And I get upset about things, or I hope this happens, or I hope this doesn't happen, or yada, all that stuff that goes through our minds. But if we can just kind of begin to laugh more and more frequently when those thoughts come up, not in a derisive way, but just like, oh, I don't need to worry about this. It's already in the bag. It's already a done deal. I can afford to relax because we're all really home, and I just need to be patient with myself and trust, and as Jesus says in his Course, that only infinite patience brings immediate results, So if we really want to have the feeling of peace, we just need to forget the things we think we need. And as it says in the Song of Prayer, and my other favorite quote from the other supplement is, I'm paraphrasing all these, is healing happens when the therapist forgets to judge the patient. Or it also is kind of analogous to saying that, healing happens when we forget to judge our reality based on temporal illusory evidence. And if when we do that, we're free, in those moments. That's the cumulative effect of choosing that consistently undoes the unconscious guilt in our mind, as we forgive those misconceptions. And eventually, there'll be nothing left to forgive, and we'll just say, okay, I'm done. but seeing the gap between where we think that there's still something in the world that we're getting mileage out of or hoping to make work for us in the world. That's I think a helpful metric to just say, okay, I've got more work to do. So nothing wrong with that, right?
Yeah, nothing wrong with that at all. And, I'm going to go on and read the next couple of paragraphs because this is good. And it's, I think it's really helpful. These thoughts that we have about, what is the difference between what state I'm in right now and being enlightened? What is the difference between my state of mind now and being truly awake or knowing, that I am the dreamer? So, So Gary says, I always wondered about that. I mean, if you're really experiencing that the world is a dream and that you're a dreamer, then why would it matter to you if anyone knew you were enlightened? And if you're really experiencing that, it's like I always say, for me, as far as the lucid, like, you know, people do lucid dreaming. Anytime I wake up in a dream, I recognize that I'm dreaming. I wake up, and I think that's the truth here. I think if you recognize that you're in a dream, if you really knew that you were dreaming, you would wake up.
Yep.
Because you would know the difference. You would see the difference between what is happening in my dream world and what reality is. So, but I don't know what reality is. I haven't experienced it in this form, in this body, in this mind. I don't know what it is. And I don't know if you can experience it in the form, in the body, in the mind. I don't know if you can experience reality, in that state. Because, you know, there's the real world, which is still an illusion, according to the Course. You know, we can wake up and be in the real world, which is much more beautiful, apparently, than the world we appear to be living in, because not because there's anything different about it, like the flowers are brighter or the sky is bluer or anything like that. It appears that way to us because we are not seeing the guilt in it.
Exactly.
And so it's recognizing the innocence of the world that we begin to see the real world, the truth and reality of what this world is. It's not a place where guilt and fear and death are run rampant. It's just a dream. And so, you know, recognizing that it's a dream, and in my dream last night, you know, I may have killed or been killed or you know, any number of things might have happened in my dream, but when I woke up, nothing had happened. And that's what we see when we go into the real world, is that no matter what the dream has told us, nothing really happened. Why would it matter if anyone knew you were enlightened? Persa says, that's a good point, but sometimes for teaching purposes, it is appropriate to say what your experience is. Gary, you mean like Buddha saying, I am awake? Persa, yes. And speaking of Buddha, he and Lao Tzu were very similar in their teachings. Sometimes things that were attributed to Buddha were actually said first by Lao Tzu, and things that were actually said later by Buddha are quoted as coming from Lao Tzu. In any case, Buddha eventually outgrew some of Lao Tzu's approach. And you know, we see that maybe Lao Tzu was restricting in his teaching. By the way, I'm taking a Buddhism class right now through the ministerial program with Awakening Together, and reading a book by Thich Nhat Hanh, and I do see, you know, what the Buddha's teaching, which I have followed for many years, I do see how the Buddhist teachings actually are not the same as the teachings of A Course in Miracles, that there actually is actually quite a bit of difference between non-duality and what Buddha taught. Or what we know of that Buddha taught from our classes and stuff, is Buddhism is really truly a very dualistic approach. And I think, if I can remember from maybe from the disappearance of the universe, that Jesus told us that Buddha was not enlightened at the end of the lifetime where he was known as Buddha. That could be why these teachings are so dualistic, because there's a lot of talk about suffering and the purpose of suffering and the origination of suffering and what we need to do to solve the idea of suffering. A lot of stuff that, you know, when you recognize that you're one with God, there's no basis for. So anyway, that's what I've been seeing.
Interesting. That also sort of presupposes the idea that Buddhist teachings were carefully and accurately conveyed to us in this era, and which, you know, given how much Christianity was distorted and modified, it's not unlikely that there might have been some at least minor distortions of what was actually said or shared, whatever. Not that I'm suggesting it was, but you know, it's so easy to get, as this, what you know, we've been reading suggests, you know, all the distortions and the changes that inevitably happen when followers, you know, pick up on something that someone said and then make a religion out of it, kind of thing. Anyway, just something. And then the other thing that comes to mind as you're saying that is in the same way that, you know, earlier versions of the Course, that, you know, for example, the Hewlin Casey version and things like that, you know, get published, which are really rough drafts. In a sense, Buddha, wasn't fully, enlightened in that lifetime. And so his teachings, in a sense, were a necessary but not sufficient, you know, condition for understanding what we're, you know, we have, you know, better and more complete, ideas now. So why not use the final draft or more up to date draft? And then the last thought that comes to mind in that regard is, a teacher named Neil Douglas Klotz, who, was an Aramaic scholar, I think probably still is. And his comment in one interview that I heard on Caroline Casey's radio show years ago stuck with me. And that he said that the word for evil in Aramaic, actually meant unripe. And I think that is such a helpful idea that, you know, the things that we want to judge or condemn, even if it's just a slight, you know, dismissal, that could have any kind of negative, you know, connotations to it. Just, it's sort of like saying, well, you know, you don't try to teach calculus to a kindergartner. You kind of wait till they've gone through, you know, addition, subtraction, multiplication, and maybe a little algebra and, you know, that kind of thing. But in the same sense that, you know, we're all unripe here. And so if we want to really, you know, ripen and mature, we have to be not only patient with ourselves, but also, willing to acknowledge that if we're all working with partial understanding, you know, that gives us a tremendous amount of opportunity for compassion and justification for it. And also for forgiveness and, you know, letting everybody off the hook, which kind of ties into that first statement that we read this morning of, you know, everyone's doing the best they can with the awareness they have. Huh?
Exactly. That assumption of positive intent.
Yeah,
really is, you know, that it's the kindest thing that we can do.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
Otherwise we assume that they're negatively intending and we assume that they're wrong and bad and they're, you know, whatever. So, yeah, it's really
helpful there. And even if we see an obvious acting out of a, you know, an ego or a narcissistic behavior or a, you know, just, you know, what we would consider childish. If we can remember, this is just unripe. This is partial information. And when we have a split mind, we're going to be doing things and behaving in ways, most typically, that are, you know, patently insane. And we can afford to forgive that, even though some of those are become more, quote unquote more difficult classrooms, but, you know, the Course reminds us that there's no order of difficulty in miracles and there's no order of difficulty in forgiveness ultimately, but, you know, give ourselves some slack when we find some situations appear to be more difficult than others, you know, that's okay. I mean, we'll get to it and we can trust that, the system of, our progress and maturing will bring to us what we're ready for, consistently, and we'll get the opportunities to, you know, take the fast track with forgiveness at every turn if we're looking for them.
Exactly, and that and only that. There's you can, once you hit that point where you're recognizing that I'm going as fast as I can.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing everything I can. I'm working as hard as I can. I am doing the maximum right now, whatever it may be. I'm doing the maximum thing I need to do because there's nothing else I can do. I can't go beyond what I'm capable of doing. It's impossible. So, you know, to think about this in terms of the fast track, well, there, you know, we are on the fast track.
Exactly, yeah. and if we're already home, what's the hurry?
Exactly.
Why would we be concerned? And ironically, it's when we have that attitude, that's when we really do allow ourselves to forgive more quickly and really do return and, you know, make the quantum jumps that the Course in Miracles suggests are possible through forgiveness. to other parallel realities where we've already resolved and forgiven, you know, whole massive archetypes of thinking that are
exactly and the thing to kind of really help is that's helpful to me to realize is that in the same lifetime where Jesus and Buddha were unenlightened, they were still the enlightened beings that they are because they never changed. It's not like, oh, they became something other than what they are. They always were that. So in my lifetime where Lynn is being Lynn and sitting here talking with you, Bruce, I'm already there. And you are. So what we're talking about is really, I think, just making the trip more comfortable.
Yeah.
I think me, it's making the trip more comfortable. It's making me less afraid, giving me more confidence, and making it possible for me to be truly helpful because I'm now not in a place of fear and consternation and feeling small and inadequate and all that kind of stuff. I am exactly where I need to be. And nothing is going to change that. I'm not, you know, no matter what occurs in my life, I'm not going to be put somewhere where it's not the right path. Nothing is going to happen that's going to change the reality of what I am. And if that's the case, then I have nothing to worry about, and neither do you. And like I said, like we were saying, we're already home. So if you're already home, there's no path. There's no journey going on.
Exactly. And if we're all bound up with consternation, we just have to give ourselves a dose of forgiveness, which is the relaxative that it brings.
I knew you were going to say something like that. I love it. I'm consternated. Oh my gosh, you're cracking me up. All right. So you want to continue on?
Sure. Let's see. Okay.
How so?
Okay. Gary says, how so? Persa, we'll be telling you more about Buddha later, but we'll point out one difference here between him and Lao Tzu because it will help explain Jay and Buddha's experience of life with Lao Tzu. Lao Tzu was unusual in the sense that even though he understood non-dualism, he was also an ascetic, and he demanded that his students be ascetics. This led his students more to an experience of semi-dualism rather than non-dualism, because if you believe you have to deny yourself worldly pleasures, then you're making the illusion real through your resistance to it. Gary, it's like if you think you have to give something up, that's making it just as real to your mind as when you desire it. Precisely. Yet it was Lao Tzu who first taught that it is desire that leads to suffering. And he thought it would help his students to give up desire by having them give up the world. He would say many things that argued against worldly participation, such as, quote, the sage, because he does nothing, never ruins anything, unquote. Gary, at last, a good excuse to be lazy. Persa, well, Buddha, who was influenced by both Lao Tzu and the Vedanta, believed the exact same thing 200 years later. But in living it, he had a major revelation. He realized that if you want to escape from suffering through the relinquishment of desire, which you could say is one of the main goals of both Taoism and Buddhism, living your life to extremes will often prevent clarity. Plus, it doesn't really satisfy you anyway. Eventually, he espoused, quote, the middle road, unquote. In giving up asceticism, which he and his followers had lived for years, he explained you don't need to give up the world if it's not real.
Good point.
At the same time, you don't have to go crazy experiencing worldly pleasures and orgiastic attempts to make it more tolerable. In other words, be normal. It's from that place that it's the easiest to actually apply the truth to the illusion you're witnessing, because you can think more clearly and you have normal situations to apply the teachings to. Notice I didn't say easy situations. I said normal. Sometimes situations in life are very hard, such as the death of a loved one, which I just learned of a friend who passed a couple of days ago. Yet, even then, be normal. If you need time to grieve, take the time to grieve. If you get hungry, eat. If you're sick, take your medicine or do whatever works for you. You've got the level of the mind and the level of the dream. They're like apples and oranges. You don't have to change the dream world, just the way you're looking at it. That's the difference between being at cause and being at effect. Your job is to take care of the cause. If you do that, the effect will take care of itself. Do you want to go on?
That's it. Mm-hmm. Once you take care of the cause, then there, and it's recognizing the real cause. And again, that's the thing that we were just going through in that Buddhism class, because in Buddhism, according to this Thich Nhat Hanh book, and it is a little different than the Buddhism that I studied before with Chogyam Trungpa. Not because, you know, he has taught a different kind of Buddhism, but he had a better understanding, I think, of the reality of the cause of what was happening. And so in Buddhism, they have this whole list of causes, and there are all these intertwining, interaction kind of things that are going on. And so it seems like they pinpointed the cause of things, but they really haven't pinpointed the cause of anything, because all of the causes are part of our understanding or opinion or thoughts or ideas about the world. So, for instance, in Buddhism, you know, they talk about right action and wrong action, right thinking and wrong thinking. And they're very involved in, if you have a job, you work at a slaughterhouse, that is a bad thing, and that you need to find a job that doesn't include murdering animals or taking care of murdered animals or whatever that situation is. And, you know, Jesus tells us in the Course that actually that doesn't matter at all. What matters is who you do it with. Mm-hmm. And so if you're working in a slaughterhouse and you are hand in hand with the Holy Spirit, and I know people will say, well, how can you be hand in hand with the Holy Spirit and you're slaughtering animals? Well, because you recognize that there's nothing real in this world. And you recognize that even those animals are a projection of a wrong-minded thinking about the truth of what is. And that, you know, the fact is that no animals can die. No, death is not a reality. You know, this is where we get all hung up on the confusion and level confusion really big time when we start looking at these things. Because if you start looking at cause as being having something to do with what you've done or what you do or what someone else has done or what somebody else is doing, you have completely negated the real cause of anything here, which is the belief that I'm separate from my source. Mm-hmm. And the belief that I'm separate from my source says I need to eat meat. The belief I'm separate from my source says I need to raise animals. The belief that I'm separate from my source says, you know, I need leather shoes. You know, working in a slaughterhouse is not a sin. It's a confirmation of the belief that what the world holds has value, and what the world gives is necessary, and that what I need from the world is sustenance, food, water, clothing, etc. That's the confusion. And so you can work in a slaughterhouse and be clear in your mind about the truth and reality of what's happening and never suffer guilt. Never suffer fear, never suffer anguish because of your job, because you don't see those animals as being anything different or less than or other than the truth of what you are. And so, that's kind of a extreme example, but it's the truth, nothing I do in this world has any meaning unless I give it meaning. Lesson one and lesson two. And so, Buddhism, where it's good, it's still a dualistic teaching, and it still is attributing cause to something that is not cause and effect to something that is not affected by the cause that they think. What I think is happening is not really happening. Basically,
yeah. And we're so conditioned to think of the outside world as being the cause of us. And it's, you know, the, as you know, the heart of level of confusion is just wanting to reverse cause and effect and say the feedback that I'm getting is really the cause rather than feedback, you know, because feedback is an effect of something, right? So if we can remember that it's just mirroring back to us the world of space-time and people and bodies, including our own body, is really just a mirror of decisions we've made in our mind for an insane thought system until we finally give up the idea that that dead horse thought system is going to do something helpful for us and realize that to be truly helpful, we just need to choose a different teacher. And there's only one other teacher, you know, besides ego's non-existent little S self, right?
Exactly. So. Absolutely. Yeah. All right. So let's see where are we are. You were reading. Are you reading?
Yeah, I think so. Let's see. We were reading about the middle road. Let's see. We did that. Okay. And, your job is to take care of the cause. If you do that, the effect will be to take care of itself. Okay. Arden continues. Even though Lao Tzu wasn't always perfect in his teachings, he was a master himself. So let's be clear that he understood the trickery of the ego. For example, when you're young, it's like you're seeing everything for the first time and you really believe you are. The veil of forgetfulness is so thick that it makes everything new and certain things hold your interest and may even fascinate you. This is the ego's trick to make it seem important and suck you in. Of course, the script is written, as the course that came later says, but you don't know that at the time. You just think it's real and amazing. Gary, yeah, I remember when I was around 3 years old, I went to my cousin's house, and there were these shelves that were behind glass. There was this really bright blue balloon on the shelf, and I was so fascinated by that balloon and wanted to have it so much. Arden, isn't it amazing how such a simple thing can mean so much to you? And guess what? It never stops. The things just get more complex, even if they're hobbies that seem important. Gary, that's true. The first time my dad brought my brother Paul and me to Fenway Park, I was 7. We lived in New Hampshire, and we'd been watching the Red Sox for a couple of years on a black and white TV. I'd never seen them in person. Then we walked down the runway and saw Fenway for the first time, and I was absolutely amazed and fascinated at how green it was, the grass, the walls, and how colorful everything else was. I was hooked. I must have ended up going there 100 times over the years, and I probably would have gone even more if I lived right in Boston. Arden. Lifetime fascinations are scripted all the way through, Gary, and there are no accidents along the path. The question is, what are they for? Gary, well, I know the Red Sox never won a World Series from 1918 and on until I forgave them. Arden, I don't know if you can take credit for them winning the World Series except on a macro level, but you can certainly get the benefits of forgiving them. Persa, because of the veil, the newness of experience will always be there from time to time, even when you get older. People always act like they're the first people to ever have a baby, and they don't realize that even if it's their first baby. It's not their first time having one. It's only the forgetfulness that makes them block out the memory of all the other families they've had over thousands of dream lifetimes. Gary, so the ego wants us to think that special relationships are vital, and those relationships start with the family and continue to be introduced. Persa, absolutely. And in the lifetime we're talking about, Jay and Buddha had a relationship also from the time they were children, but they weren't ordinary children. Because of their previous Shinto discipline, their minds were already more advanced than your average person who isn't particularly interested in the unseen. In fact, they were what you would call psychic or clairvoyant. Gary, when I was a kid, I never felt like I was clairvoyant. I think I had clairavoidance. I forgot you said that. That is good. As I was saying, they were unique. Not special, but unique in their ability to save time. That led to being in the right places at the right times. Gary, wait. Quick question before we go on. How many lifetimes did these guys know each other in? Persa, they weren't always guys, but it was about 40. We're going to mention only the 7 most relevant ones. Gary, 40? That's quite a bit, isn't it? Arden, that's not really a high number at all. There are beings you've known several hundred times spread out over thousands of dream lifetimes. Jay and Buddha didn't have as many lifetimes as you because they didn't need them. And the reason their relationships will appear to be so important to you is that they knew people who were famous and were also spiritual masters. There's a good reason for that. Remember, they didn't believe in the dream as much as others. That's why they were ready to be with people who were ready to teach them. Gary, so it's like when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. Martin, yes, and vice versa. Should we wrap it up there for this week?
Yeah, I think so. And actually, it says that in the manual for teachers as well. Yep. That is almost completely, in fact, the manual for teachers says almost exactly that very same thing, that there are people that we've known over lifetimes and that they come back over and over, and that we have mighty companions that are, that have been our friends and acquaintances and all sorts of relationships that we've had with them, but that we do tend to come back together. And it's almost like, in me, it's like we have like a group or something. I kind of feel that with a lot of people. You, I feel that with.
Oh,
that
for
we
sure.
That we are connected and have been from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. It's like when you first know about a person, you know your connection to them. And so, you know, we come together as teachers and as students and as healers and as whatever it is that we come together into. It's all of the purpose. It's all of the purpose of giving up this idea of the world and giving up and accepting the atonement. That's really what it's all about. We come together to accept the atonement. That's it. And, Jesus says, how many teachers of God are needed to save the world? And he says there's only one, because
that's the only light bulb that needs to be put in.
Exactly. And why is the delusion of many necessary? Only because reality is not understandable to the deluded. So, there really wasn't a Jesus and Buddha. There really isn't. I mean, these are all illusory lives, and eventually we come to recognize that that we've been deluded by this notion of many, this notion of lifetimes, this notion of anything, and we begin to see the truth and reality of what we are, which is none of that. Thank you anyway, Bruce Rawls, for joining me this morning.
Oh, always a pleasure.
Yeah, always a pleasure.
It's just
wonderful. And I'm going to mention that tonight we have Jennifer Hadley at 8 p.m. Eastern. So I'll be interviewing her. And that'll be interesting and fun, I hope. And she'll be on the second Saturday of every month from now on. Thank you, Bruce, and I'll see you again next week.
Likewise, Lynn. Have a great week.
All right. You too, hon.
Love to all. Bye for now.
Love you, brother. Bye-bye.